This is a recording of the public hearing on hybrid communications held by the Federal Election Commission on July 11, 2007. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good afternoon. The special session... The special session of the Federal Election Commission will reconvene. Our second panel today consists of Sean Carencross on behalf of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, Mark Elias on behalf of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, Donald McGahn II on behalf of the Illinois Republican Party and the National Republican Congressional Committee, and Brian Schwoboda on behalf of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Each witness will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement. The green light at the witness table will start to flash when you have 1 minute left. The yellow light will then go on when the speaker has 30 seconds left, and the red light means that it's time to wrap up your remarks. The balance of the time is reserved by questions by the commissioners. As with our earlier panel, we will proceed alphabetically. So Mr. Carencross will be the first to go. After that, we will have Mr. Elias, Mr. McGahn, and then Mr. Schwoboda. So, Mr. Carencross, at your convenience, please proceed.
Well, good afternoon, Chairman Lenhardt, Vice Chairman Mason. Thank you to the Commission for having us here to testify today. It's much appreciated. I know on behalf of all three party committees that our comments represented. I will briefly summarize the RNC's and the NRCC and the NRSC's comments, and then make one or two additional points. In sum, we believe that the Commission's existing regulations are adequate to govern hybrid ads, and that is ads with a specific federal candidate and a generic party reference, a specific federal candidate or candidates and a generic party reference based upon time space. As a personal matter, I would have no objection to a 50-50 safe harbor provision for a single candidate ad in the presidential context, and Mr. Josefiak covered that earlier this morning, and I believe, as he does, that in context outside of the presidential campaigns, I can certainly envision situations in which a 50-50 split may not be appropriate or may not govern. With respect to the generic party reference, we do believe, and I know it's clear to me that the Commission is not in agreement on this, that it is a self-enforcing mechanism to a degree, and that is a standard of reasonableness should apply on the basis of if you try to draw a distinction and impose particular monikers that a party must use, list examples. By virtue of doing that, you are engaged in a content-based restriction, essentially, on party speech and its ability to identify itself or its counterpart in a way that it deems appropriate. And that's not to say we'd like to throw this to the wind and rest on your enforcement procedures, but it is to say in our past history with this, our recent history, is that in 2004, both parties appeared comfortable with the identifications that the others made, and that there is an enforcement process should a party committee run an ad that crosses the line, and both parties certainly are aware of that, recognizing, however, that not everybody is deals with this on a day-to-day basis inside the Beltway, and that the Commission is subject to change in personnel, and that the law does change.
Don't rub it in.
No. Commissioner.
He was referring to the empty chair.
That's correct. Thank you. Tap dancing for a second. That if a regulation is necessary, we do believe a unified approach works well, and that would be, as we stated in our comments, to amend 106.8 to cover all communications. And it would also entail some addition of language addressing multi-party or multi-candidate ads, and that would also then be allocated on a time-space ratio. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I believe Mr. Elias, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. I will I'll try to be brief and make two points which are not covered in our written comments for my opening statement. Several weeks ago, I had the honor and the privilege of testifying for the Senate Rules Committee, something I know several of you had the honor and privilege of doing recently as well. My topic was less interesting, which was the potential repeal of Section 441AD. And let me just state clearly at the outset by way of, for clarity's sake, I testified there and offered my own personal views, not those of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee or any others, but the in my testimony there, which raised some eyebrows, I think, I vigorously defended the need to keep the 441AD limits. And one of the reasons for that, which I received vigorous questioning from both sides of the aisle, had to do with the fact that that this agency is capable of having rules that give parties breathing room under the 441AD limits, that you are not bound to a fixed interpretation of 441AD that counts every dime that is ever spent in a way that might benefit a candidate against 441AD. And as a matter of public policy, I argued to the Senate Rules Committee, it would be better to allow the law to develop at the regulatory, at the administrative level, in a fashion that allows 441AD to remain, allow it to remain in an environment where parties are given wide latitude to determine which expenditures are and are not counted against that limit. This rulemaking is the first opportunity to see whether or not my prediction to the Senate Rules Committee turns out to be correct or not. Frankly, and I say this not with any someone who supports the 441AD limits, I suppose I say this hopefully, I hope you come to a conclusion that does not push Congress in the direction that, frankly, on a bipartisan basis and interestingly enough, on a across-the-spectrum basis, they seem to be leaning, which was that the requirement that every party expenditure or most party expenditures that involve public communications be counted against 441AD is not desirable. And I think you have an opportunity here in the hybrid rulemaking context to make clear that that's not true, that there are going to be ads that benefit the party and benefit candidates, and in that way give parties the opportunity to manage their 441AD limit in a way that does not require its ultimate repeal. That's one of the reasons why I support the 50-50 extension of the phone bank regs to other forms of public communications. The second point I just want to make briefly has to do with complexity, and this is a subject that I turn to over and over again every time I appear before this agency, so I would be remiss if, having done it in every other rulemaking, I didn't do it here. McCain-Feingold is a very complicated law. And my clients, now speaking on behalf of the DSCC, my clients, my Senate campaigns, my party committee, are constantly trying to figure out what the law is. Is it 120 days before an election? Is it 30 days before an election? Is the biaggregate annual limit for out-of-cycle contributions to Senate candidates counted in this cycle, or are they counted in future cycles? You all change your minds a lot. Now, some of it, in fairness to the commission, has been the result of litigation. Okay, but where there is something that is clear and bright line, that is preferable to something that is not clear and not bright line. So as between a 50-50 rule that may in some cases be slightly over-inclusive, in some cases might be slightly under-inclusive, or a how do I measure an ad versus how does Mr. McGahn measure an ad, and how does the general counsel's office treat a visual of this candidate versus a visual of a party, rather than getting into the uncertainties that come with that, I would rather have this commission put forward bright line, clear rules so that we don't wind up in a situation where we're explaining to our clients again, well, you see, it's not actually that simple. If they hear me say one more time it's not that simple, they may fire me, which would be unfortunate for me and my family and my firm. So those are the two points I wanted to make. One is that as you go about today, I would have you keep in mind the fact that that what you're doing involves all hard money and is actually a way to preserve the current regulatory regime. And second, that I would urge the commission to take an approach that is going to value simplicity over 100% precision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. McGann, you are next.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, Commissioners, appreciate the opportunity to be here and testify today on behalf of the NRCC and the Illinois Republican Party. First, I'd like to note that we appreciate the chairman's questions ahead of time. I'd never seen that before. Very helpful in preparing the testimony. I hope to address those in my opening comments, and then if there's follow-up questions, happy to answer those questions. My clients want to bring a little bit different perspective to the table, and that is those who are not running for president, those who do not necessarily think of hybrid ads as their first method of communication, but nonetheless would wish them maybe to be something in the future they would like to do, depending on circumstances. I caution the commission against passing a rule too soon and a rule that would preclude future conduct by party committees and other federal candidates other than those running for president in an effort to judge what the last cycle or cycle before did or did not do. For example, it is certainly within the realm of possibility that a state party would like to do an ad that uses a federal candidate in the ad to simply draw attention. The federal candidate gets on screen and says, I'm Congressman Jones, and like I've done in Washington, the Republican Party in Illinois is really doing a job standing up for Illinois values, blah, 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 and he talks about the party for the remaining 30 seconds of the ad. If you adopt a arbitrary, for lack of a better word, 50-50 ratio, that's not really fair in that case. When you come at it maybe from the presidential perspective, maybe 50-50 makes some sense. I'm not really passing judgment on that. I want to come at it from the other perspective, where there are going to be situations I see where the party committee really will be the primary beneficiary of the ad, whether it is for folks who are down ticket or simply because the party wants to get its own message out, brand its own image, push legislation, issue advocacy, whatnot. My clients just want to bring the perspective of not a one-size-fits-all rule based upon the presidential model. The issue of nicknames is interesting because regardless of whether you do time-space, which is what my clients recommend, we see that as the current law, and we think that works fine from our perspective, or a 50-50 or some other rule, it really begs the question as to what is a party reference. Clearly, if you say Republican or Democrat, I think we all agree that's a party reference. To turn to the chairman's questions, and in order, Congressman Nex has been battling the liberals in Washington. It's tough to say without seeing the full context of the ad. On its face, on its four corners, I don't see a party reference there, nor do I see one for the second. Photo of the Capitol, you really need context on that one. The fourth quote, we think that's a maybe, depending on context, because presidential candidate, again, a little bit different than my clients, working with congressional leaders to pass key legislation that could be a party reference depending on what congressional leaders we're talking about and what legislation we're talking about. The fourth point, does it matter if an ad refers to other political actors and their status as legislators or as opposed to candidates? I don't think so, because the party has an ability, whether or not they're actually flacking for a candidate or flacking for an issue position or just a party position, the distinction between referencing a legislator or a candidate I don't think is a distinction in this context. It is maybe issue ad versus express advocacy and it passed MERS where the commission gets, but in this context, I think it's an apples and orange comparison. But that still begs the central question of nicknames. The Illinois Republican Party is housed in the land of Lincoln. It's the party of Lincoln. In Illinois, that's a nickname that makes a lot of sense. It's not something that someone in Hawaii would maybe instinctively think of as a Republican thing, but certainly for the Illinois Republican Party, that would be something that anyone looking at it would think that's a party nickname. So I heard Mr. Hurstein's comments earlier about providing examples. Those are always helpful. There's been prior rulemakings where there's been examples in the ENJ, very helpful. But again, you cannot possibly, sitting here today, come up with all the possible labels that someone may ascribe to a party committee And ultimately, aside, in addition to the possible circumvention arguments that are made, you're also touching the spending side, which is something that really is a little bit different when you pass a reg. It's one thing to enforce limits. It's another thing to reach out and touch speech. And if you reach too far and try to be too precise with the nickname issue, you're going to inevitably cut off creative thinking, which is something that my clients do not hope does not happen. With respect to the enforcement, and I'll just wrap up. I see the red lights on. Again, it's a situation where you're regulating spending. I think there needs to be some deference to determinations made at the time. This is not a novel concept in American jurisprudence. You know, appellate courts review trial court rulings all the time. There's de novo review. There's clearly erroneous, and then there's the in-between, abuse of discretion. Not really hard to see how that would work. There is always the temptation of an auditor, general counsel's office, or a commissioner, or majority of the commission to second guess. But I think in this case, there is precedent for deference. Ever since the commission is formed, FECA, FCRA, regardless of where we were in our trajectory of law, there's always been wide discretion in the spending of campaign funds. It's not the sort of thing that the commission second guesses. Matching funds, different story. But regular campaign funds, commission does not get in and micromanage whether or not that was legitimate campaign spending short of personal use. So there is precedent for deference. I think that could be useful here as an example. And with that, I conclude my comments and happy to answer any questions. Thank you. Great.
Thank you very much. Mr. Swoboda.
Well, thank you, everybody, for having us here, to the commissioners, and thank you to the staff for helping set this up. I, too, am grateful to Chairman Lenhart for the questions, but also to Steve Hursting for the answers. It's like the really smart guy in my law school section who took good notes and made copies for everybody before the test. I'll be really brief. The big issue, I think, for the commission here in this rulemaking is this is about how political parties are going to work after BCRA. When BCRA was written, there was great pains, I think, taken by the Congress to try to at least recognize the balance of the parties versus other players in the political process once they passed the law and restricted various people from doing various things. It's why, for example, you saw not simply a soft money ban on the national parties and soft money restrictions on the state parties, but you saw also the electioneering communication restrictions on outside groups in Title II. There was a great fear that the power of the parties was going to be diminished relative to outside groups once the law began to play out. Well, it's appropriate we're here now because 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court just blew a hole of whatever size in Title II of BCRA. And how that's going to play out in terms of that distribution of power in the system, I mean, really remains to be seen. But it puts an urgent question before the commission, which is the commission's answer to that situation now at this time going to be to give parties the flexibility and the certainty they need to plan their own affairs and spend what is their own hard money, and I'd emphasize that, their own hard money, in light of these developments? Or is the commission's answer going to be altogether different, as one of the commenters urged on the commission, to not only ask the parties to continue to operate within the tight restrictions of Title I of BCRA, but to take those the principles of those restrictions and apply them also to the question of what is or isn't a contribution or what is or isn't a coordinated expenditure for purposes of the campaign finance laws? And that would be an altogether new development for the commission and for the Congress even in the history of the Federal Election Campaign Act. As my colleague Mark Elias mentioned and as Mr. McGann mentioned, the Act and Commission advisory opinions and Commission rules are replete with instances where the Commission has stopped short of saying that every expense that can be construed to provide some level of benefit to a candidate has to be captured by the coordinated expenditure limits. I mean, here at the House and Senate levels, we're about to see an example of that this cycle. There's a form of exempt activity available only to the presidential ticket that allows for telephone banks to support the presidential ticket. And the Commission's interpretation of those rules has always allowed an incidental message of House or Senate candidates in that phone call. Clearly, there's a benefit being derived to the House and Senate candidate. Clearly, in any even-numbered year that's not divisible by four, you would have a contribution or coordinated expenditure. But you have nonetheless an example of where the commission has allowed parties to spend money in support of its House and Senate candidates and not capture all of the benefit that they're going to derive. The commission has made a judgment, or Congress made a judgment, that it was important to preserve the institutional power of the parties and their adherence with their candidates and their identification with their candidates to allow these sorts of things to happen, that it was not simply good for the candidates, but it was good for the party as a whole. And that brings me, I guess, to the last question, fundamental question that's before the commission today, which is, do the parties have a role, do the parties have an interest that continues beyond the support of their candidates right here and right now? And the answer to that, I think, obviously, is yes. I mean, for example, I listened to some of the discussion in panel one and some of the questions that Commissioner Walter asked about the use of hybrid advertising in battleground states and how hybrid ads tended to be ran in battleground states such as Michigan. Well, in Michigan, for example, you saw very competitive races for the state legislature where the balance of party control, you know, is very much at this moment in play. And you saw Democratic gains that people on my side of the aisle were very happy of. You saw a Democratic governor who won re-election under circumstances where it did not seem at all assured going into the cycle, and you've recently seen a Democratic senator win re-election. So these presidential cycles, even at that moment when people are thinking about a particular candidate, you have an interest for the party in building the party in a particular jurisdiction for the long haul, not simply for future presidential races, but also at the state and local level as well. So those are the questions I think we'd like the commission to think about today, which is just what is the role of the parties after Bicker, and how much freedom are they going to have, or little freedom are they going to have, to manage their hard money resources, and do they have anything to do other than simply supporting federal candidates? And the answer to that latter question, I think, clearly is yes.
Thank you very much. Questions? Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you. Mr. McGann, your comments reminded me of Richard Nixon. Everyone thinks of Richard Nixon as a supremely unpopular politician, but at one time that was not the case. My former boss, Trent Lott, got elected to Congress the first time by appealing to voters in Mississippi that Dick Nixon needed Trent Lott in Congress. He doesn't want to remember that, but that was there. And what it reminded me of is the fact that in the 1970 elections, Nixon actually did ads for Republican candidates. Now, it was a little simpler. First, we didn't have FICA, and he wasn't a candidate. But it brought home the example or the reality of the fact that you might have someone, and it would be very easy to imagine, for instance, a popular senator in a state being asked to cut an ad for the state party, say, on behalf of legislative candidates. And I don't think any of us would have the purpose of prohibiting that. But if we did that, and you mentioned this, that, you know, it becomes a different problem if we had matching funds, how would we write in such a distinction? In other words, let's say the senator's in cycle, but he's running away with a race, and that's all the more reason that the state party wants that senator's support. In other words, he's polling 75%.
That's
There's an opponent on the ballot, and so their strategy is to get everybody who pulls the lever for that senator to pull the lever for their party's candidate, and yet there you got the senator on screen.
Absolutely.
How do we write a rule that allows the state party to pay for all of that, but doesn't allow the state party in the next state where the senator's in a 50-50 race to put their candidate on screen?
That's why it's you end up with the lesser of all evils, I think, unless you just deal with my clients would prefer a system where we can make judgments based upon what we think the value is to the respective participants in the ad. I'm not so sure that's going to go anywhere, so I'm not going to belabor that point, which is why, to me, the time-space method makes the most sense, because at least that is something that you can measure, and then when producing an ad, objectively pass judgment on, at least as a lawyer advising the client. And at least the creative folks in the political world, you can give them framework and say, well, it's going to be how much time somebody's on the screen versus, you know, picture of Lincoln and the flag and the eagle and everything else talking about the party sort of thing. And that is something that works, whereas the 50-50 doesn't necessarily reflect reality when it comes to how much time is on the screen or whatnot. And you're, I hope I don't personally remind you of Richard Nixon. I hope it's the ads Richard Nixon were in made you think of that. But I agree with the point that you're going to have different things in different states, and different candidates are going to be in different perspectives. And what I see in the future is, because state parties are becoming increasingly limited as to what they can and can't do, and they have to essentially use all hard money when it counts anyway, to use federal candidates who aren't in particularly competitive races to help, whether it's turnout or party message or whatnot. And frankly, the candidate who may be running away with it probably doesn't really want to be in the party ad, but if all of a sudden he has to pay 50%, he's going to say no. But if you can present an ad that says, listen, you're going to be in it for 10, 5 seconds, and you're going to pay this much, can you do it? Okay, that they may say yes to that. So it is a concern, and that's why I think time-space is really the proper approach, because that's something that you can objectively hit a stopwatch and work with.
I just add one thing to that. I think also supports time-space, and that is, even in a case, say a Senate race where the senator is running away with it at that time, politics is a very fluid thing, and I can think of at least one race last cycle where a senator who was leading heavily suddenly was not, and therefore the value to the senator to being attached to an ad with the party may have suddenly increased in his view, and therefore I think time space is probably the correct way to allocate that cost.
Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I just want to follow up on this, because Mr. Elias, if I understood what you were saying, I think your view was that the time and space is too complicated or too liable to second guessing, and because of that, you'd prefer a simple rule if there's two federal candidates mentioned in a generic party reference, it's one third. I mean, is it because it's too liable to second guessing? Is it?
Yeah, and let me say a couple of things about that. The first is, it's not self-evident. I mean, just to be clear, it would be fine with me, but it's not self-evident that everybody else in this room would agree that a picture of, quote, Lincoln, the flag, and an eagle is equal in time space to a picture of a candidate. And that's one of the problems with time-space, is that you wind up, how do you depict John Kerry and the Democrats? Okay, I know you depict John Kerry, show a big picture of John Kerry. You put a picture of the Capitol, you put a picture of the Democratic headquarters building, you put a picture, a generic shot. Well, these are all real examples.
Do you do a shot
of the chamber where you can't make out individual faces, but you see them all sort of sitting there? I mean, so the problem I have with time-space is not conceptual. Okay, it's not conceptual, it's practical, which is that time space for radio is relatively straightforward, and for mail, a little bit harder. For TV, I'll just tell you, and I realize I'm sort of jumping hats here, but I watched all of the Bush Cheney ads, okay, all of them, from the first ad they ran to the last ad they ran, and it never occurred to me that it was anything other than 50-50. And I think if Mr. Josefiak was here, he'd say that it never occurred to him it was anything other than 50-50. In other words, I wasn't breaking out a ruler to see how it was they were going to depict Bush and how they were going to depict other generic Republicans unmentioned on the ballot. If I had done that, and if we had done that, we'd have 350 FEC complaints pending before you right now. We'd be back in the days. In 1998, the National Republican Senatorial Committee filed a complaint against every ad run in the entire country by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. This is back in the days of issue ads. And we did the same thing back. And if we get back, and that was because back then we had all this squishiness about issue ads. And now, if we get into time space, it's just an invitation into, how do we decide whether or not this was in fact, frankly, if we want to go with Mr. McGahn's, the parties decide how much benefit is derived, with a presumption, that I think is easier.
You mentioned the difference between, meet different media. I mean, we've had some discussion here about how there ought to be a unified rule because that's simpler. I mean, would you prefer that, even though there's easier ways of doing it with different kinds of media?
Yeah, I think there ought to be one unified rule.
Okay.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you. I assume then, Mr. Elias, that you're not in favor of the enforcement as a method of figuring it all out down the road.
Well, let me just say one thing about that. You know, the answer is no. I mean, I think that there, you know, there are regs that you all have passed over the years that lead to natural enforcement opportunities, and there are those that don't. I would advise for favorable consideration the polling reg. Right? You can do it this way, you can do it this way, or you can do it any other way that's reasonable. Okay? Probably not that many FEC complaints get filed around the polling rules. They're both clear cut, you know, this number of days, it counts this much, this number of days, it counts that much. And then when you get into allocation questions, there's a lot of discretion left to the parties. I will note one thing, though, about enforcement, which is that I believe, and I may be off by a couple, but I believe that during the course of the 2004 campaign, John Kerry for president and Kerry Edwards 2004 received 19 FEC complaints. So it was clear to me that the Republicans and the people who didn't like Senator Kerry knew how to find the FEC and knew how to file a complaint. I don't think I'm revealing any secrets. None of them involved hybrid ads. And as far as I know, I'm sure the Bush campaign found themselves in the similar position. And none of those complaints involved, as far as I know, obviously not subject to privy to whatever is confidential with the agency, but I assume none of those involved hybrid ads. So I don't think there is a huge clamor of enforcement queued up against hybrid ads. The DSCC ran hybrid ads in 2006. We did a lot of hybrid mail. We did a lot of hybrid radio. We did some hybrid television, and we did some hybrid phones. As far as I know, no complaints filed. So I don't fear the enforcement mechanism because I don't think that there's a clamor for it out there. But I would not recommend that we gin one up.
Well, if I may, Mr.
Please.
Chairman. You said, I'll go back to you at first and then I'll ask everyone else to comment, but you said you're in favor of the 441AD limits, and I'm not sure that anyone else on the panel may agree with you on that, but you said that, and that Congress was considering changing them. Of course, they've been considering changing them for quite some time. And obviously, if they wanted to double the limits, they could. That's one option that's available to Congress. Now, one of the other commenters, who is not here with us on the panel, has suggested that a 50-50 rule would be an effective doubling of the 441AD limits. So I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond to that. Why? How can we, in our given that we're supposed to be enforcing the 441AD limits, and I agree with everyone who said, you know, we don't want to say every single thing that a party does should count against it, but doubling the limits is kind of a big deal without congressional action. So I'll give you an opportunity to respond to that.
Two things I'll say is, one is I assume that the earlier person was a member of the reform industry or reform group.
It's a written comment from, yes.
Yeah, and what I find curious about this is I wake up one day in 2004 and see what is now, I understand, to be a hybrid ad, the first Bush hybrid ad. There's an AP story later that day saying that this is what the Bush campaign did. I was the general counsel of Kerry Edwards' campaign. I scratch my head and say, huh, that's interesting. And then I read that Larry Noble, who at the time was with one of those groups, proclaims that it's perfectly legal. Okay, fair enough. I look at it, decide he's fundamentally right. We go ahead and do the same thing. So now fast forward, it's time to deal with 441AD repeals. Turns out the reform industry was all in favor of repealing 441AD as part of a deal to do away with 527. So I never quite know what to make of the comments from the reform industry about 441AD, because it seems like sometimes they're in favor of them, sometimes they're in favor of getting rid of them, that they're functionally meaningless. I mean, I testified on a panel with someone from one of the reform groups who was talking about how 441AD is functionally meaningless. So, you know, I'm not sure I know what to make of any one particular set of comments. I will say this, it is not a doubling of the 441AD limits. The fact is there is a benefit derived by the party in these ads. I'm not arguing that the party should run ads that are simply candidate ads. I'm saying that hybrid ads benefit the party. What I guess I'm quarreling with slightly is that we should worry about the precision about whether or not that ad benefits the party 40% or 60% at any one ad. And we can just say, you know what, we're just going to say as a fiat, those ads benefit the party 50-50.
And if I could add a comment to that, I mean, I got my start in politics before practicing law working for the Nebraska Democratic Party in 1988, when you might recall George Bush was running against Michael Dukakis, who was immensely popular in the state, and when Bob Kerry was running against Dave Carnes. Now, if you'd had an ad in Nebraska in 1988 sponsored by the Nebraska Democratic Party saying vote for Bob Kerry in the Democratic ticket, the Campaign Legal Center, through their comments, would say that 100% of that value should be ascribed to Bob Kerry. Elias and Swoboda would be here telling you it should be 50%. Our colleagues on the panel would be saying it should be allocated based on time space. If you'd asked his campaign manager in 1988, he would have told you that the value was zero. In fact, it would have been sub-zero. In fact, the NRSC would have taken that ad, put their disclaimer on it, and run it to great effect. I mean, so that goes to show that all of these are rough judgments about benefit derived, and that there is some diminished benefit in most circumstances to a candidate in having a reference to a party as long as themselves. Because if you left them to their own devices, you wouldn't have a picture of Abraham Lincoln and the Eagle and the Capitol next to the candidate. You'd have just another picture of the candidate. I mean, that's what they want. And so there is necessarily some accommodation, some diminishment of the value that they make when they participate in a hybrid ad. So it's an example, I think, of how even time space is not always it's a rough judge for trying to figure out value, but it's not always an accurate one.
Well, indeed, some of this goes to Commissioner Walther's questions earlier about target states and hybrid ads appearing therein. And the campaigns themselves and the candidates have to, not just the parties, have to make an assessment of value to these ads, and they are independent. The parties not only have down ticket concerns, but building the party brand is very important to the Republican Party. It's very important for us to try to attach our brand to our entire ticket of candidates, and thereby grow the party. So there is absolutely independent benefit that's derived from a hybrid ad from our perspective.
Do you have any evidence of that? I mean, we had asked if there was any empirical data, and nobody came up with any, so, you know, we have to look to other sources, I suppose. But what can you add to that, any of you, in terms of evidence for the benefit to the party of the hybrid ads?
Well,
Commissioner, I think actually that those benefits are extremely hard to quantify. I think they may be impossible to quantify, and I'll give you an example. I mean, the Republican Party from 1968 to 1988 invested a lot at every level in their operations to develop the term, quote, liberal as a brand for the Democratic Party. And you know what? I mean, they succeeded. And those efforts paid off, I mean, not simply in 1968 or 1972. I mean, they paid off for Republicans in, you know, many jurisdictions in the country in many different ways at many different levels. And, you know, the effect of that, I mean, it's apparent to us all as political professionals and people who are familiar with politics. And you can say the same things about similar efforts on the Democratic side of the aisle, the Gingrich Congress, for example. But, you know, each of these, it goes to show that these effects are real and perhaps impossible to quantify. I mean, when a party tries to brand itself, develop adherence for the long haul, it's something that transcends electoral politics. It's something that serves the party for years and years and years in myriad different ways.
The only thing I'd add to that, which is very anecdotal, and I don't want to portray it as anything else. I mean, my experience at the Senatorial Committee is that when we engaged in a hybrid ad program, which we did last cycle, hybrid media program, we had interest from not only the party but from the down ballot people. I mean, the fact is when we did hybrid mail in Missouri, for instance, you know. Obviously, Senator McCaskill was happy, but so were the people at the party, the people who were on the ballot with her in what was, in a non-presidential year, a battleground state. So, I mean, anecdotally, these are activities that are not shunned by. In fact, they're appreciated by the down-ballot people and the party because, as Brian's, I think it was Brian who said this, all things being equal, they'd make the entire mail piece about McCaskill. I mean, you know, all things being equal, it would just be a McCaskill piece. So there is there is some trade-off in the making of it making it hybrid, and especially with the allowance for exempt party activity, you can easily make something entirely one candidate focused and still have it not account against 441 AD. So, you know, I think that there really are benefits, but again, that's anecdotal.
If I could jump in, I I agree that it's very tough to quantitize benefit. But as a representative of a state party, I see it at that level almost every day. I mean, in Illinois right now, the focus is much more on the state-level politics. Governor there, newspaper articles all the time, corruption allegations, all sorts of things, usual kind of stuff I guess you see in Chicago, who knows. But the party is very concerned that what they are trying to do with their message, which they hope will pay dividends down the road, is going to be snuffed out at some point yet again. Bicker was tough enough on a state like Illinois. It's a corporate money state, essentially similar to Virginia. It's kind of a full reporting, anything goes kind of state. And all of a sudden they learn they have to, you know, spend a lot of hard money near election day, and now they're trying to do an off-year branding that'll maybe help them next year, the year after that. And they want federal office holders to help. And the fact that just the nature of the things I'm seeing, I it's tough without revealing privilege or really inside baseball to get into details, but I can represent to the commission on behalf of the client that it certainly is there's all sorts of anecdotal evidence, and certainly in their minds, all sorts of reasons that would answer your question. And I think I'm the only commenter from a state party. So,
Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I'd like to ask the panel as a whole, although play off something that Mr. McGann said, and that is, I'm assuming that if we were to come up with or say that the standard's going to be time and space allocation, that, I mean, do you all believe that the kind of standard that the commission then ought to use in an enforcement matter, it sounds like you all probably would be in favor of almost an abuse of discretion. In other words, we would not overturn what the party decided was the proper allocation unless we really thought that they had abused their discretion more than just a reasonable standard. I mean, what do you think about the standard we ought to use?
I think that an abuse of discretion standard would, if such a thing would fly, would be great.
Well, but it flies.
I don't mean that in a smart way. What I'm trying to say is,
but that standard flies every day,
right,
in federal and state courts. It's not a novel concept that there's deference given. Now you can come back and say, but that's two different decision making. You know, it's all court.
Exactly. Yeah.
But nonetheless, the idea of deference to a decision made at the time is not something novel in our jurisprudence or legal system. Abuse of discretion has the advantage of it's a term that we understand. You know, we would certainly welcome that sort of standard. The fear, of course, and I think this is part of what Mr. Elias is hinting at with the merits of the 50-50, is you don't want to be second-guessed. And 50-50, at least you know you won't be second-guessed. But 50-50, from my perspective, my client's perspective, doesn't really get you there either on the practical side of spending. So I think some sort of deference is in play, should be there. And again, there's plenty of examples, even in federal election law, where there's deference given to spending decisions that are not second-guessed by the commission. And polling reg is a good example of where you do have quite a bit of discretion, and you have per question or, I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can allocate a poll. And although there aren't a lot of MERS, you know, occasionally in audits, people get a little antsy about how you allocated polls. So you maybe want to let the auditors know that the rules are as easy as you say they are. But that's an example of a situation where there already is a rule that allows for discretion, and there is some deference given as to judgments made.
And Commissioner, I think your question, at least to me, seems to acknowledge that how you make a time-space allocation, depending on the media in particular, you can do it any number of different ways. I mean, one of the things I've had to do in practice for the last 10 years is, in context outside the hybrid context, you know, just figuring out time-space for multiple candidates mentioned. And I can tell you, as you sit with the ruler and the abacus and you calculate it out, there's four or five different ways to slice the bologna. And some of them are more aggressive, some of them are less aggressive. And, you know, the question is, you know, how are people going to be able to approach that task reasonably, you know, with some certainty that they're not going to be second-guessed, you know, if they approached it reasonably, you know, some years later?
And in a sense, an abuse of discretion standard is the way that the parties, at least my party has thought of this in the past, and with a self, in a sense, with a self-enforcing mechanism that we had without a regulation between the parties, and as Mr. Elias said, virtually no complaints filed on hybrid ads. The parties are wary of or aware of what the other party is doing and are paying close attention. So we have been operating, in a sense, under that standard right now.
Mr. Elias.
Yeah, the only thing I just add to this is that if you go time space, that would be very helpful. You know, I am very wary that unless it is very, very clearly stated and clearly articulated that that is the case, that that will hold over time. I mean, I've had recent experience with this commission, which will joyfully for all of us continue for some time, where there is a regulation that says 60% of a cost, only to have the auditors come in and say, well, no, but we meant to incorporate GAAP into what we meant. Even though it's not in the reg, we meant to incorporate that. And the fact is, that's one presidential audit where the auditors get to import one phony standard into an audit, but we can't have that with party hybrid ads. I mean, you know, that's a presidential audit. It'll be a one-off deal. We'll hammer that out at the appeal stage. But where you're about to promulgate rules on things that involve core party activities that parties and candidates are going to rely on both sides, we can't wind up in a place where it looks like we have certainty when in fact we don't have certainty. So I would actually prefer just 50-50, because I don't think there's any way even the audit staff can read 50-50 as anything other than 50-50.
Commissioner Walther.
One of the things that I think was on our minds as we were dealing with the audits, you're dealing with public funding, you're dealing with us deciding to what extent was the public funding augmented by hybrid ads, and feeling a special sense of responsibility in that particular case to exercise our judgment and determine what's reasonable and what's not, and whether that would translate into other situations is probably less likely. But I think all of us here would love to have the opportunity to have a line that would work without us having to second guess everybody. And so we were unable to agree, as you're quite aware, on a 50-50 split. And if we look at a way to find a bright line standard, say a fixed percentage, then what factors should be taken into consideration if we can't agree on a 50-50 split? A couple of things that were important to me, as I mentioned earlier this morning, was the fact that so much money, and I mentioned roughly 85% of the money was on hybrid ads was spent in battleground states for Republicans, and roughly 92% was spent on the Democratic side. That doesn't necessarily militate that percentage precisely, but on the other hand, it is a factor on what people think when they spend their money, the benefit is being gained. If they really want to help the down ticket in some areas, why not spend the money in some state where the president's really popular rather than just on the ragged edge of 50-50? So, I mean, I look at that and I think it's hard to agree on a 50-50 split in that particular case. On the other hand, I don't think we want to get in the business of weighing every ad and taking a look at how you calculate it amongst yourselves and giving you the benefit of the doubt with whatever standard we pick. So I see you always saying we want specific guidance. I don't blame you. I would feel the same way.
Well, let me just address the 92% because I can speak to that from firsthand experience. Senator Kerry was being asked to pay for half of those ads. So the deal is, if the Ohio Democratic Party wanted Senator Kerry to help the down ballot ticket and the Idaho Democratic Party wanted John Kerry to help the down ballot ticket, we were more likely to help the Ohio Democratic Party ticket because we were paying for half the ad. Now, if the commission wants to pass a rule that we don't have to pay for any of the ad, where it's helping down ballot people, then I'm sure you would have seen hybrid ads in other states. But we can't lose sight of the fact that there was a candidate component to those expenditures, and therefore you need both the party and the candidate to agree to spend in that jurisdiction, for the same reason that you now see candidates more willing to raise money for the Iowa Democratic or Republican parties than they probably are to raise money for the Idaho Democratic or Republican parties. It doesn't mean that the party is getting any less benefit from the attendance of that fundraiser. It just means that the candidates see more utility in helping some parties more than others.
If I could chime in on that a little bit and pick up on that point. It's tough to look at the money spent on just one ad and draw a conclusion that therefore someone was trying to stretch the coordinated limits or play games with where they were spending in certain states, which is why arguably the matching funds regime is a little bit different, spending limits, that kind of thing. My clients don't see that so much. But you need to really look at the more, to the extent you're really going to go down that road, realize that how complicated it is to allocate assets for a campaign. We're dealing with all hard money here. We're dealing with how to split up who pays for what share of an ad. There is no moral rule here that we're playing with. There is no metaphysical correct limit for coordinated expenditures. For example, on the mail side, hybrid mail, hybrid help, that's okay. What about do it as volunteer mail? Fully coordinated with the state party committee, all hard money, volunteer component. There's a myriad of examples where for every ad where you think, gee, that maybe that was a little bit odd, there's all sorts of other explanations why it's really not in context. So that I just want to make that point that there's many ways to skin the heart. And from a state party perspective, hard money is such a premium. Those sorts of decisions are going to become more complicated, not less complicated. And this is why, to us, the time space makes more sense.
Ms. Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. I wanted to direct this question to Mr. Elias, but others could comment as well. And I just wanted to press a bit more on your preference for the 50-50 allocation, if we haven't done that enough already. And that is, I understand that you prefer it because it is a bright line, and that time-space allocation or attribution can have its practical problems. You know, and that also the benefit to the party is difficult to quantify. But I would ask, why that particular bright line? What evidence could you offer for the commission that that bright line is more defensible than, say, a 75% bright line?
It's a good question. It's a fair question. And let me answer it a couple of ways. First, which may be unsatisfactory or may leave you feeling empty, but the commission already adopted a regulation with 50-50. So it held a rulemaking very similar to this one and determined that 50-50 was the place to be. You know, since that time, there have been 50-50 ads run in two publicly financed presidential campaigns where there have been audit reports adopted by the commission that, with dissent noted, have been nevertheless accepting that. So if you go back to my opening statement, some of it, and this is where I realize it may leave you sort of feeling like that's not enough, but some of it is this is what the regulated community, on the Democratic side, for what it's worth, we refer to these more often as 50-50 ads than we do hybrid ads. I'm willing to use the nomenclature hybrid ads because we it's recognizable, but it is kind of ingrained in the culture somewhat at this point that these are 50-50 ads. Doesn't mean that can't be changed, and I'm not sure that that's a satisfactory answer to your question, but that's at least as much as anything else why.
We actually call them split ads. The 50-50, to cite the prior rulemaking, I assume that's a phone bank. We're talking about
phone bank.
The thing about phones, and this really doesn't help. I'm actually kind of piling on and not really helping the 50-50 argument. I'm explaining why somebody may sue, which is really the gist of the question. How do you defend the 50-50 in case someone says, well, it really should be 25-75, this is arbitrary. Phones are a little bit different than TV and radio because phones, given the myriad of state laws, whether you need a live fronted call or you know you do a robocall or a hybrid of a robo, and there's so much on the state level that regulates how you do calls that it's very difficult to really time a call. If it's a live phone bank, let's say it's a state where you have to make live calls, somebody could read it quickly, somebody could read it slowly, somebody could, you know, read the candidate part fast and the party part really slow. And so 50-50 there, I think, makes some sense. It seems defensible because you have so many different, I don't think anybody's going to sue you over 50-50 split on phones. TV and radio and mail a little bit different. You take out a ruler, you take out a stopwatch. So I'm not so sure the 50-50 can be justified on the same basis as the phone. I think it's an oversimplification to say, well, the phone rule is 50-50, so therefore we can do 50-50 everywhere. It's the opposite answer that I think you were hoping for, but it's food for thought. Maybe you can
Vice Chairman Mark.
You know, I think, to respond to Don a little bit, I mean, one of the things I think it illustrates is that time-space has never been the exclusive means within commission rules for analyzing, I mean, the division of benefit. And, you know, the polling regulations, you know, are the classic example of that. I mean, the commission developed a schedule for the diminishment of poll value over time that, I mean, I hesitate to say it was arbitrary. I mean, it's survived for 20, 30 years. But, you know, I don't think that the, you know, the benchmarks in terms of time frame and percentage value, you know, were developed, you know, based on rigorous scientific analysis. I think it was based on the commission's best expert judgment as, you know, based on its own experience, frankly, as people who, you know, either have used to be political professionals or regulate political professionals and see what they do. I mean, their sense of just how much utility, I mean, that poll had over a stage of time. So I think the law permits you to make those rough judgments. Now, why 50-50 versus 75-25 or 100-0? I think 50-50 is more defensible than 100 or 0 if you start from the premise that the candidate enjoys a diminished benefit of the ad by the inclusion of somebody or something else. And I think that can be readily documented in the course of a rulemaking. That brings you to the question of why 50-50 versus 75-25 or some other number selected. 50-50 strikes me as a proxy for recognizing that that the value has been diminished. So, for example, I mean, again, to go back to the polling regulations, if under the regs as now written, if, you know, there is a poll done and two people purchase it, the rules would regard that each side basically is having 50% of the value of the poll. It's divided by the value of the number of the recipients. Even though each of the people has an entire poll, there's a sense implicit in the rules that the value is diminished based on the fact that somebody else has it. And so you have at least an analogy that you can go to in other commission rules where you've made that sort of rough judgment before.
I hate to speak again, but the 50-50 approach, assuming you pass a reg, which my clients don't feel you need to do, but assuming we go down that road, a 50-50 rule would be much more defensible if it were one of two or three other options, where you have a 50-50 approach, you have a hybrid approach, and maybe you have an actual value approach, not unlike the polling reg. And I think if someone would challenge the 50-50 approach, you then have a much more flexibility in the reg to say, well, you're not stuck with 50-50. That's just one way you could do it. You could elect to do another way.
And one final comment on that is the 50-50 does have, I think, some difficulty addressing a multi-candidate hybrid ad. And that's something I think the commission should consider as well.
One of the things that we struggle through here a lot is that, you know, there's this sense that everybody wants a clear rule, but the one that allows a lot of flexibility. They want it to be simple, but it also should be tailored for lots of different circumstances. And you know, for whatever else we do, we should make sure that it isn't the kind of thing that gets sorted out in enforcement. And when we actually get to trying to put pen to paper, it's hard to achieve all those goals, right? And yet that's what, you know, in essence, we try and do. And I want to turn a little bit on to talking about what the generic party reference, what the regulation should say about what is necessary to qualify as a generic party reference. And I want to approach it two ways. One is I put out a couple of different examples of communications. I think some were into the questions that I originally posed to Mr. Hostring. I think some one to Mr. Karen Cross, where I had actual text. And the question was, you know, do these rise to the level of the reference to a generic party communication? There's one possibility that we simply, you know, define that simply as a party name or nickname. The other is that we give examples. Others have suggested we simply provide people with as much flexibility as possible. Mr. McGann was kind or brave enough to actually say which of these he thought, you know, qualified as generic party, references, and which did not, and which were close calls. I'd appreciate knowing both a mixture of how you read these kinds of communications, whether they qualify as generic party communications, and therefore if they were placed in an ad, whether it would qualify as a hybrid ad, and secondly, and probably more importantly, how you think we end up best off phrasing that to meet those all of those somewhat inconsistent goals. Anyone want to take a stab at that?
Well, I suppose I will start, since one of the questions was specifically addressed to me, and I believe the question was an ad that said she stood shoulder to shoulder.
I'll read it to you because I've got it in front of me. Which blessedly, I didn't. I've brought all my questions to the meeting with them today, as I did, which because they're mine. The four or five examples I had. The one to you was candidate X has stood shoulder to shoulder with those who are soft on terrorism. In vote after vote, she's refused to give our troops the support they need. I didn't give a close out. The choice is now. The decision is right. Yours, or something like that. The others included Congressman X has been battling liberals in Washington. Congressman X has been battling the tax and spend crowd in Washington. A photo of the Capitol behind a candidate that was running for the executive branch. Presidential candidate X has been working with congressional leaders to pass key legislation were the examples that I tossed out there.
Right. In specifically with the shoulder to shoulder on terrorism and something like that. And I know Mr. McGann addressed the prior examples earlier, and said it's a little bit difficult to take out of context as a single standalone statement. That statement alone, shoulder to shoulder with those who are soft on terror, I don't believe would qualify.
Even though the next sentence refers to her votes on the Hill?
To the individual, to the candidate.
To the candidate's votes on the Hill, and it doesn't draw, okay.
That's right, to the candidate, but not to a generic party. But there again, in an ad that says, that finishes, vote for or vote against candidate X and her colleagues in Congress or the Democratic Party.
The question gets a lot easier if you put and the
sure.
Democratic Party at the end of the ad.
Right, but not to since we're here to testify, not to ask questions. I'm nevertheless just tempted to ask a question, which is that, in 1996 or 1998, it was Newt Gingrich. In 2006, more contemporaneously, it was George Bush. I mean, Tom Kaine and the Bush team want New Jersey to do X, Y, and Z. On Election Day, vote against Tom Kaine Jr. and the Bush team. Was there any doubt in anyone's mind that we were making a generic party reference for Republicans? I mean, I think pretty much people knew that the Bush team didn't include, Democrats in the state of New Jersey.
Yeah.
George Bush is fabulously unpopular in the state of New Jersey, I might add, and was being run away from by Don's clients in the state of New Jersey, I might add. So it was a more effective way, frankly, than saying the New Jersey Republican Party, which is actually less unpopular in that phraseology. So our nickname for the party in New Jersey, the Bush team.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think you need to leave that flexibility. I mean, I grant you, the shoulder to shoulder, I share the skepticism.
So is there a way to phrase, to do the drafting part of this that doesn't leave it just, off to enforcement to figure out whether they were close enough and whether they agreed or not? And now maybe we get to Don's point where in enforcement we, approach things with a more relaxed view of what it constitutes a nickname. But does that provide, I'm not sure that gives you guys any guidance as you're trying to figure out whether you're to approve the ad or not before it goes out the door. What do we do in terms of a reg?
Well, the regs certainly include the obvious references, party names. The New Jersey example is one that is transient. I mean, in 4 years, running an ad, about the Bush team is not going to make a whole lot of sense. So it's tough to sort of quantify those. And that's really the challenge, and that's why the reg does need to build in the flexibility and the deference to the decision-making, because otherwise you're going to lock in, because I'm not sure I could write a reg that encompasses all potential names other than in the ENJ list examples that are maybe contemporaneous that when, you know, down the road can be used by analogy.
And in part, I think that's contained in the definition of a hybrid ad. It contains a clearly identified reference to a generic party, and that I think gets to Commissioner Von Spakovsky's point as to what standard.
I do want to clarify one thing, because I do think there was a disconnect at times during the 04 cycle, and in this discussion, I hear it again. There is one theory upon which you could pass these regs that says what you're trying to do is help the candidate and the party. There's another theory in which you're trying to help the candidate and generic unnamed candidates of that party. And the phone bank reg is actually not about the party. It's actually about other unnamed candidates of that party. So I personally would say that either should suffice, but I do think it's important for the commission to spell that out. In other words, whether we're trying to help the Democratic Party or we're trying to help unnamed Democrats in running the ad.
Vice Chairman Mason.
There's been a little bit of circling around on this panel. I think it maybe was even more direct on the one before about, and it's implicit in some of this discussion of options. If we were to take a position that said we'll draw a safe harbor but leave time and space or something like that, how would we do that? In other words, would we draw the safe harbor on the party side or the candidate side? We did, you know, in the AO, as long as it's at least 50% is paid for by the candidate, or would we say as long as at least 50% is paid for by the party? Well, it makes a difference. And
I suspect there's unanimity among us.
Well, okay, that's fine. And then if we do that, what do we say about the time space? Do we just leave it where it is? Do we give some other guidance as to when it would be supportable or what factors we might look at?
No one else wants to take this. I think you could do what you did in the polling allocation regs. You could say, a candidate or party may allocate the ad in any one of the following ways: 1, 50-50; 2, time space; 3, any other reasonable method of allocation. And that would.
And then, in terms of how you deal with that in the enforcement process, I think there's a presumption. It maybe reflects the differences in perspectives between where you sit and where we sit, but I think there's a presumption perhaps on the commission's part that every complaint that comes in about one of these ads, assuming that there is any, necessarily needs to be a priority in the enforcement process and needs to, you know, occasion stern to bow review and a completion of the process. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, the commission has prosecutorial discretion. I mean, the commission can decide how important or how less important this issue is relative to other priorities, what sorts of cases are ripe for review and what sorts of cases, you know, are not ripe for review. I mean, I wish I knew what the enforcement priority system looked like and how it was written and how I could tell my clients to safely avoid it.
If it were up to me, you would know.
But the fact of the matter is, I mean, the commission can make these judgments. So, I mean, while one way I think is, as Mark talked about, spelling out, you know, some regulatory criteria that give people a basis for proceeding, you know, the commission also is just going to face a decision as to, assuming the complaints do come in, I mean, how are they going to review them? And actually, probably more to the point, I mean, Don mentioned this earlier in the panel, what sort of instructions are you going to provide the auditors during the field work when they audit state parties? Because that's probably the way in which this issue is going to most likely come up. It may be the only way in which this issue is going to come up, which is in the commission's audit of state party committees.
Yeah, I mean, the hard thing, obviously, for us is, especially when you get into TV, these are big ticket items. You know, and to see them in enforcement means that there's a lot of dollars after whatever's involved. And so to the degree that we can sort of find, you know, provide, you know, enough clarity at the front end that people can shape their decision-making in the pre-spending phase accordingly, it makes life, I think, for everybody a lot easier. Because once they end up, now you indicate that nothing certainly has come out of the pipe, and you may not be aware of anything involving hybrid ads so far, but to the degree that, you know, you do end up in the enforcement side, the TV buy dollars on these are give you there's a lot at stake.
Right. Well, you know, it occurred to me, this may not be directly responsive to Commissioner Mason's question, but there is another context where the commission has had to implement spending limits, has sought to provide relief to people, you know, from those limits to some degree and give them reasonable basis of complying, and it's the presidential primary public funding state limits. I mean, the commission basically said there are going to be five categories of spending that are going to count against a state cap, and these are it. We will list them for you in the rule, and if it falls into one of these categories, it counts. If it falls outside of the category, it doesn't count. So, you know, that's an example of how perhaps you can provide, you know, it maybe is roughly analogous to what Mark talked about, you know, the reference to the polling rules and, you know, presenting the option of time, space, or 50-50 or a benefit reasonably derived. It also, I think, drives home another important point, though, which is the commission in interpreting the spending limits, whether in the presidential primary process or the party-coordinated expenditure limits, has never been the catcher in the rye standing at the end of the cliff catching every dollar before it falls over. I mean, it has always historically given some flexibility in the interpretation and enforcement of these limits.
Which I think is distinguished from a safe harbor, right? I think there's a difference between a safe harbor, mm-hmm. where you almost have to prove that you fit into it, versus a reg that gives you options. And I think what I'm hearing is more the option approach, like the polling reg, not the safe harbor approach. It took me that long to think through and answer the question. And now I understand that is it 50 for the candidate or it depends on. Now I know what you're asking. Don't have an answer yet, but.
Yeah. Would you like to take a few more moments so you can think through some of the earlier questions? Just teasing.
I'll come back tomorrow and.
Well, as I indicated earlier, the record will remain open for an additional week, and so obviously I'm not sure everybody was here for that, but upon discussions with our council, we will be keeping the written record open for an additional week if people wish to submit further information. Other questions, comments from the commission, the staff? Oh, I'm sorry.
I just want to state for the record that I think Mr. McGann bears absolutely no resemblance to Dick Nixon.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. This concludes our hearing on the Commission's proposed revised rules for the hybrid communications. I would like to thank the witnesses for coming and attending. Mr. Elias, we promise that if we have another session with four witnesses, we will look at a bigger table so that you'll have full use of that. Thank you very much. This brings the meeting to a close.